This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Growing up in New Orleans, Yaba Blaye's life was in many ways influenced by the color of her skin. She was a first-generation Ghanaian-American, and she was proud of her dark skin. But she started to notice that this set her apart from the area's light-skinned Creole community. As a child, Yaba remembers not being invited to her best friend's birthday party because she was too dark. Later in life, her skin tone kept her from being invited to a colleague's wedding. Experiences like these led Yaba Blaye to study colorism in the African diaspora. In 2013, she published One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race. Through dozens of perspectives, the book grapples with questions like what exactly is blackness and what does it mean to be black? These questions now guide Yaba Blaye in her work at North Carolina Central University in Durham. She is the Dan Blue Endowed Chair in Political Science at Central and my guest on the State of Things. Yaba Blaye, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Take us back to your earliest years in New Orleans. Tell us about growing up in that city.
Well, New Orleans is a magical place. It remains one of my favorite cities. I was born and raised there. My father graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also a professor, and his first job was as chair of sociology at Xavier University. And so I grew up on Xavier's campus. And New Orleans is a special place. Lots of history there that comes to impact our lived experiences. And for me, I had a unique experience, I think, because I was raised by Ghanaian parents. And so my home was Ghanaian. And then, you know, to walk outside and be very much immersed in the African-American community that has some nuanced understandings of who they are. So interesting, to say the least.
When did you start noticing those nuances and those differences?
I mean, as a child, you know, I tell people that, you know, my skin color is reflective of my Ghanaian ancestry. And so in my family and in Ghana, there's nothing unique about my skin tone, you know. So that was normative at home. But again, stepping outside and being told from the time I was very young, you know, you're so black or, you know, you're dark. Like, it was constant commentary and it was something that continued to come up. And so I knew very early on that there was something different about me.
Was this something you took home? Did you talk? Both of your parents are from Ghana.
Yes.
So did you talk about it at home?
You know, I honestly don't remember talking about it at home. My parents, they were strict and they were on a mission. And so I knew that they sent me to school to learn. And so coming home to talk was to talk about what I had learned. I don't remember actually talking about those kinds of personal concerns with my parents.
What about your father's sense of being here? Did he detect any of that, or was that any part of his experience as a professional, as an academic who had studied in the United States?
You know, what's interesting is that when I got to grad school and started mapping out my research and talking to my father about my work and what I wanted to do is when he started telling me his own kind of stories about his experience in New Orleans. And my father is much darker than I am. And so he talked about literally getting to New Orleans in the early 70s and having colleagues on campus not wanting to sit next to him because of his skin color, not wanting to, you know, associate with him. And maybe not just because of his skin color, but then he's also African, you know, coming from another country. So, yeah, he had his own experiences with colorism as well.
Well, and tell us about those traditions growing up in a household with African parents from Africa. What about those cultural traditions and how many of those did you honor at home?
You know, it was just normative. I mean, from the language to the food to my connection to other people, we're very familial in the sense that I was raised an only child. I have an older sister who grew up in Ghana. But even though I was raised an only child and it was just myself, my mother and my father, I always felt like I had dozens of aunties and uncles and dozens of cousins. So there are people now who I could introduce you to and say, this is my little cousin. And there's no blood relation, but it's family and it's love. So culturally, that was big in the home. Music was big in the home. Dance was big in the home. But what's interesting is that our culture, even though it was specific to Ghana, in many ways, I've always still felt connected to many other black people from all over the place. So my parents had an international crew of friends, you know, particularly from West Africa, but also from the Caribbean. And then connecting it with New Orleans culture, which is very much African in a lot of ways. I didn't feel like I was in culture shock. It was a smooth transition, I think, and I've been able to, even now, I'm able to navigate those spaces and find the ways in which I'm connected to people who look like me.
There are cultural differences, are there not, or were, in the way men and women treat each other and hold each other in regard?
I mean, yeah, to some extent. I often talk about my struggles, because I do identify as a feminist in this moment, and that can mean different things for different people. But I think when I was coming into my feminism, and I've talked about this with folks, I feel like my father raised me to be a woman that he would never date, you know? And so I know coming up, particularly as a teenage girl, looking at my mother and not necessarily wanting to be her, because what I saw, for example, you know, dinner time, she would cook. I would help her cook, maybe. My father would get served. We served ourselves. We sat down. We ate. Dinner's over, and she would take his plate and then come back to the table with a bowl of water, hand soap, and a towel. And this man would sit in his chair and wash his hands. And I'm looking at him like, well, you got it good. You know, I want to be like you. But, you know, when I grew up and became a woman and started talking to my mother, I came to realize that she wasn't doing it because she was being forced to do it or being subjugated into some submissive role. She did that because that's what she wanted to do for her husband. And I know that to be true from a very genuine space, knowing the type of woman my mother is and the ways in which she nurtures. She shows love through taking care of people. And so it helped me to adjust my feminism, I think.
Well, I was going to say that's the important part in all of this, the expansiveness of feminism and what it can mean. If you take the time to investigate it and inquire the way you have.
Absolutely.
Well, so you are a parent yourself.
I am.
And tell us about becoming a parent, and because that's an interesting story in itself. You became a parent in college.
I did. I started school at Delaware State University, where my father was teaching, and I became pregnant in my sophomore year. And so I transferred because it was hard enough already being Dr. Blaze's daughter. I didn't want to deal with all else that would come with being Dr. Blaze's pregnant daughter. So I transferred. And I had my daughter the summer between my sophomore and junior years, and I still graduated on time with honors. And so for me, that experience of becoming a young mother, I mean, I still don't use the language of teen mother. And I think that's just my own stuff, particularly surrounding the ways in which people, I think, denigrate teen mothers. So for me, I remained focused. I wanted to graduate on time. I wanted to keep going because, I didn't want anybody to ever look at me and say I'm a teen mother and having a baby ruined your life. But more importantly, I never wanted my daughter to look at me and think that she kept me from doing anything. And so she knows everything I've written has been dedicated to her. She knows in conversation. We're very good friends. I always tell people that my daughter raised me. In a lot of significant ways, but I never wanted her to think that she kept me from doing anything.
So what's the most significant way, or what are some of those ways in which she raised you?
Well, you know, when you're 19 and you have a baby, you got to grow up in some very real ways. You know, it's not just about you anymore. But then it also made me, I think, become committed to this notion of career differently, because it wasn't about me just doing what I wanted to do, but doing something in a way that I would be able to take care of her and take care of myself. And so I grew up real fast. You know, I think I had college years, freshman, sophomore year, junior, senior year, I was grown and had to be.
What were your career aspirations? What were you going to do at that point?
Interestingly enough, it's hard being raised by an educator. It's hard being raised by an African man educator as well. And so I feel like, particularly being the only child in the house, there were a lot of hopes and dreams and pressures on my shoulders. And I've always rebelled against that. If there's nothing else about, I'm consistent in terms of my approach to things. But I always kind of push back to these ideas that I had to do something for any particular reason. And so I remember I quite seriously wanted to be a hairdresser when I was in high school, and my father and mother were like, you have lost your mind. Like, we did not come to this country for you to be a hairdresser. So I remember trying to pick a major, and it was literally like the process of elimination. I did want to be a sociologist because that's what my father was. Didn't want to do math, didn't want to do science, didn't want to be a doctor because if I see blood, I'm going to pass out. I did think about being a lawyer at one point. I did think about being a forensic psychologist. And so I ended up majoring in psychology. Then I thought I was going to be a clinical psychologist. And then I decided I didn't want to go to grad school because I was a young mother and I was tired and I needed a break. And so I remember my first job was as a social worker for Big Brothers Big Sisters. And I quickly learned that a bachelor's degree does not yield enough money for a young mother to take care of herself and a child. So I decided to go back to school. And thinking of my experience as a social worker at Big Brothers, the thing that I liked the most was talking to families and to the children. And so I went back to school to do a master's in counseling psychology. I graduated and I became a therapist. I also worked on at the university's counseling center. And very quickly I learned for who I am and my personality, sitting in an office 8 hours a day, speaking to young people who really struggle to even talk about what they're feeling, let alone letting you help them. It wasn't going to sustain me. And so I knew I needed to go back to school. And again, thinking of my father's life and growing up on campus, I liked his lifestyle. I figured I wanted to teach. I just didn't know what I was going to teach. And it was one of my mentors who very quickly said, well, why don't you study African studies? And it was like a light bulb went off, like, why hadn't I thought of that? And so that's how I ended up going back to school for African-American studies.
We'll find out more about those studies and where it has taken you when my conversation with Yaba Blay continues. She is the Dan Blue Endowed Chair in Political Science at North Carolina Central University, also the author of the book One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race. And our conversation will continue on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest is Yaba Blay. She is Dan Blue Endowed Chair in Political Science at North Carolina Central University, the author of One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race. I want to talk to you more about hair because you said at one point you thought that that was going to be your career, and you moved on, obviously, and you now have a career in the academy. But it was important to you, and there was a kind of a rebellious moment, I guess, in your childhood where this whole thing, not I wouldn't say the whole thing came together, but it was a pretty interesting story.
In terms of me wanting to do hair?
You wanting to dye your hair red, I mean, at some point, or there was a kind of a, you were going to go with two-tone. Salt and pepper was big, I guess.
Salt and pepper was big.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So I joke, but it's so very real. I tell people that I'm a professional black girl. And by that, I mean, like, anything that black girls was doing, I was in it, you know? And so very into hip-hop culture. My connection to hip-hop culture is that I danced, you know? So I used to dance in the street. I used to dance for people. I used to perform. And I remember when Salt and Pepper came out in the 80s, and my experience of them visually, they were the first female MCs, and they were fly. And so their hairstyle, I had to have it. And so I had it. And the thing about New Orleans culture, hair was very big, you know, and I don't know that it's specific to New Orleans culture. I think it's probably big in most black communities, but there was a ritual, you know, that you went to the hairdresser every 2 weeks and you might stay there all day. And then there are people who come through the shop to bring lunch and sell other things. It was an entire kind of communal experience. And so I also remember my mother feeling like, well, you're too young to have a standing appointment for your hair, and which is how I learned how to do my own hair. Girlfriends would do my hair. But at the time in New Orleans, we started getting into dyeing our hair with Kool-Aid. And I wanted to dye my hair with Kool-Aid, and so I did. And I remember it was cherry cola, and I thought it was fly. My father
smelled great.
I mean, sweet. My father would take me to school every day, and so I don't know. I guess I must have done it the night before or whatever. Get up the next day to go to school, and I'm ready to go. And my dad looks at me, and he's like, "You're not going anywhere." And I'm like, "What do you mean? I have to go to school? Like, let's go to school." He's like, "No, you'll sit here and wait for your mother will deal with this, and wait for your mother to get home." And I stayed home that day and waited for my mother to get home, who came home with a box of black dye and dyed my hair back. And so it's interesting when I think of my relationship to my hair now, I think it's also very oppositional in a particular way, to the extent that for my mother, especially, because what we know is that relationships around hair, surrounding hair, a lot of times our first kind of experience is that relationship between a young girl, a little girl, and her mother, because your mother's responsible for doing your hair. Now, again, Ghanaian mother, had I been raised in Ghana, I would have a shortcut like I'm wearing now, because all children, male and female, wear their hair very short. It's not until you go to college that you're able to, I guess, assume your gendered hair performance. So she didn't know how to do hair. And my pictures show that. And so she would take me to the hairdresser to make my hair more manageable for her. And then I learned how to do my own hair. But my mom's thing was always about, and what I know to be true, and true for a lot of mothers, how I wore my hair was a reflection of her. It was her reflection of her ability to take good care of me. And it was a reflection of her ability, I guess, to train me on how to appear in public as this little black girl. So I learned very early on that my hair was something to be dealt with. I think we learned some of our earliest messages when we're sitting in between our mother's knees about the texture of our hair, about the beauty or lack thereof of our hair. And so I've always known that my hair was something to be done. And then I came into myself in high school, and I went natural, which means I cut the chemicals from my hair. And my hair is a long-standing battle between me and my mother, even now that I'm in my 40s.
But even when you tell the story, the respect and the love for your mother comes through. The idea that you understood what when she used the word manageable, which could be a euphemism for look like something more acceptable.
Yeah.
You understood why she took that on as a mission, or how?
Well, I understand that now.
Understand at the time.
I understand at the time, no, because I'm like Salt and Pepper's hair looks like this, you know.
That gets to, I think, the beauty and the nuance of your work in general. How you can hold all these things together. The fact that you that we all sort of have should have the privilege to choose an identity and then identify with those things, particularly in pop culture. Mm. That we, for one reason or another, identify with and want to link our identities to. At the same time, how sometimes destructive these can be when we're not in control of the creation of these at their inception, how they get started, and what they ultimately mean and what they signal to the general public.
Yeah.
I mean, is that part of – I mean, that's what I see there. It's an important part of your work, that you can – that it's not a crime – to embrace a particular style, but understanding how you came to that style and what it might mean to the larger public is kind of an important understanding.
It's that, but I think more important to me is what does it mean to you? You know, because I think as human beings, we spend a lot of time performing a lot of things for other people, and it doesn't take us to our happiness, you know? And so for me, I think as an educator, but just also as a person, I'm about people thinking critically about all kinds of things to ultimately understand their personal relationship to it, because it's what drives us in a variety of ways.
It's a personal relationship, but also, but often to constructions that we didn't have any control over. I mean,
right.
You, for instance, you did research, or you looked into skin bleaching, which was an important topic. I mean, people would do this not because inherently, perhaps, they think it's, but because generally it turns out to be more acceptable. There are privileges that come.
Right. And so with me getting into the work on skin bleaching, I think one of the motivating factors was having looked at the literature, a lot of which was journalistic, and having male reporters talk about women, African women who bleach their skin, and talk about them in such a way like, well, these are just foolish African women who want to be white. These are just women who are suffering from a colonial mentality. And I know very early on I was driven and moved to, for lack of a better word, defend them. If nothing else, to show their humanity, right? Because you're not just talking about women who exist in a vacuum. So if we want to be real and we want to talk about a colonial mentality, so women and men bleach their skin, yes, but our judges and people in parliament in Ghana, for example, still wear powdered wigs. We still name our children by Christian Western names. We don't teach languages, our own native tongues. We don't teach that in the school because we think that students need to learn English in order to be acceptable and successful. And so what I'm saying is that there are so many different manifestations of this so-called colonial mentality. It's just too easy to pick on African women.
I see. But then but what about any of these sort of adaptations to an imposition? I mean, do you see some of these values as superimposed by colonialism or any other kind of
social construction? Absolutely. Yeah. So I think historical context, political context is always important. So if we're talking about skin bleaching, see, my thing is we can't pathologize people. You pathologize people when you don't provide a context within which to understand why they are behaving, why they have the needs that they do, or the wants or the desires that they do. Like, we're not existing in a vacuum. So when I look at skin bleaching, we got to look at that in the context of white supremacy. We have to look at that in the context of the history of colonization in that space. And so even though the British may have left Ghanaian soul, they left their values behind. you know? And so if you have hundreds of years of a dominant force basically telling you that, you know, literally because of the color of my skin, literally because of where I come from, it's almost like I'm ordained to be in power. Not just I've earned this, but this is my rightful place in power. And it's very much linked to how I look and where I come from. And so African people also wanting some access to that power. How do I get access to it? Right? We got to throw in commodity racism in there. Right? So you make products for people to bleach their skin, yeah, and then you denigrate them for using it. It can't work both ways.
How did that work, or did it lead to the kind of work you're doing today?
The
research in skin bleaching?
I think skin bleaching is just one manifestation. Like, my kind of perspective on colorism is there's so many kind of manifestations throughout the world, and not just in Black communities. It's wherever we find people of color. And so skin bleaching became a particular manifestation of colorism. But I'm interested in a lot of ways that it manifests, I guess.
So talk about this book, One Drop. What led to your putting this together and the stories in it?
Right. So prior to conceiving of the project and working on the project, I had done my dissertation on skin bleaching, which was a massive undertaking. I had also done research on women in New Orleans who identify as Creole, so looking at their identity politics as well. And so just as a trajectory, my work looking at colorism for the most part was looking at the socio-political disadvantages that come with having dark skin in a racialized society. And so that's one perspective, and I think that's the dominant perspective in the discourse on colorism in terms of direction. But there was always something in the back of my head that said there's another side to this. There has to be another side, because if we understand institutions, we know that they disempower everyone involved. So patriarchy disempowers both men and women, for example. White supremacy disempowers us all. And so looking at the other side, in fact, one of the first iterations of the title was The Other Side of Blackness. But what I wanted to do was to talk to people who were on the lighter end of the trajectory and get some insight into their experiences with colorism and the ways colorism impacted their lives. This particular conversation became nuanced, however, when I connected the skin color and the aesthetic and the phenotype with racial identity. And so everyone in the book identifies as some form or another of Black. They use different terms to identify. But because of their personal appearance, most people question their Blackness. So I thought it would be an interesting starting point to talk about Black identity, because they're always talking about Black identity. So for me, I've never had to justify or defend my Blackness. I walk in a room, I don't have to say I'm Black. You don't question whether or not I'm Black. It's just the a priori fact of my existence. There are lots of people who actually spend a lot of time defending their Blackness. And so I thought that that would be an interesting entry point into this conversation about what exactly is Blackness. What does it mean to be Black when you don't, quote unquote, look Black?
Well, and it was clear to me that most of the people you talked to in this book had to think about that deeply. This was not the first time they were asked. In fact, frequently it was like, I'm really tired of the question, where are you from? Or that sort of thing. And for white people, I'm interesting in the introduction in your book, or I think maybe in the preface, you point out that you're going to capitalize white and that that's controversial, that sometimes people don't, because of the assumption that white people make that they don't have to think about their skin tone.
Well, bigger than that, I think what's interesting, I wrote that preface because I capitalized Black, right? So that's my starting point. What's interesting, having written over the years and submitted things to different journals and publications, having editors always make my capital B a little B. And it's always bothered me, because I know, you know, one of the first lessons we learn in English, right, is you capitalize things that are important. And my Blackness is important. I'm a Black human being, which is different than a Black crayon. And so for me, I always have to make that case. I mean, I've had editors say, well, then you're going to have to put a footnote. That's fine. But the fact that we even have to argue this case that human beings should be capitalized is a problem. In that same vein, there are a lot of people who believe that Black is a politicized identity and white is not. I think white is as politicized as Black is. And so when I'm talking about human beings, everybody gets capitalized.
Well, you had to make whiteness a thing in order to make white supremacy what it is, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, otherwise it's not, and it wasn't for most of history until we started trading in human flesh.
Absolutely.
And the commodities that surrounded it.
And people are deeply invested in a white identity, because we're not talking about Italians, Scottish, right. Jews. We're talking about the conglomerate of those people to create an identity that's called white. And white has power in this world. And so we can't overlook that at all.
Well, and you also point out the fact that it still needs to be pointed out is telling. But that so much privilege is built on it, that white supremacy is built into the law, was certainly when you talk about slave codes. But beyond that, even into Jim Crow, the whole idea that blood quanta is going to define you and it's going to be on your birth certificate well into the 20th century,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And 21st century.
And it's important to know that history and that context, because much of what we understand blackness to be today has been meted out to us, right? That it's been given to us and we receive it and move on with it. And so for me, it's about pushing people to think about, okay, can we identify and define and characterize blackness outside of that space? Because what we know about the one drop rule, literally what it sounds like, that all it took was one drop of black blood to make a person black. Understand the context. That was about protecting whiteness. That is white supremacy at play. It is to say we are defining whiteness as pure. And any little bit of any of that other is going to make you non-pure. So it was definitely about discouraging interracial relations. But it was also about consolidating white power.
But you had some interesting things to say when Beyonce came out with, did Formation. the idea of who can speak on this, and given her situation as, you know, sort of being from a light-skinned woman from New Orleans, making this statement. How do you feel about that?
You know, I feel all kinds of ways about it. I am a Beyonce fan. But I think what I was commenting on with that song, when she made the lyric, you mix that Creole with that Negro, get a Texas Bama, that people from New Orleans understand how problematic that feels, right? Because to say so is to distinguish Creole from black, which has been part of our lived experiences, where you literally have folks who create neighborhoods and say, if you're darker than a brown paper bag, you don't come to this neighborhood, you don't go to this church, your babies don't go to this school. Right. Mm. It says who was the first, second, third black mayor, quote unquote, black mayor, what they look like, you know, what last name you have, how you trace your ancestry, that all those things create relative power in this place. And Beyonce is a powerful woman, you know, so it's not to say, because I've definitely had a lot of folks kind of push back and say, well, Creole is an identity. It absolutely is. It's an identity. It's a culture. There's a legacy. There's a history. So it's not to say that you should not be proud of your Creole heritage, but it is to say, we have to understand blackness as a political identity, that there's a time to be Creole and there's a time to be black.
What is she saying? I mean, I'm wondering about the effect of it all. I mean, here's somebody who has that kind of a platform, who has that stage, and who frankly doesn't have to go there politically at all.
Right.
Right? She does not. The next Beyonce album is still going to be platinum, whatever she does.
Right.
And almost, you take a risk by really walking into this. Does it take a Beyonce to point this out and to speak the unspeakable, to risk the challenge in order to get us past some of these conversations, or the kind of Disney-fied small world after all post-racial nonsense that then passes for, okay, we're past all this?
You know, I'm not sure. I think there's a lot going on there. I do say that Beyonce didn't have to make that song. She didn't have to make that video. And she didn't have to perform at the Super Bowl in the ways that she did, right? And so, yes, we're thankful that she is using her platform in that way. But, you know, it's just interesting to see how people respond to her, the extent to which people were willing to boycott her, you know, because I think it says a lot about who people expect Beyonce to be. So how dare you stand before millions of people at the Super Bowl and have the audacity to make a statement. We didn't pay you for that. We didn't bring you here for that. You don't get to be black right now. I really love the Saturday Night Live clip where they talk about when white people figure out that Beyonce's black. Beyonce's always been black,
yes.
You know?
But also, and you pointed out, I think, something else in your discourse or your comments on this, which is that again, in New Orleans, this kind of imagery is going to be powerful and triggers some thoughts.
Yeah, and I think visually, I think that's where I struggled. I still haven't watched the video to its end. Yeah. You know, when I see her on top of that police car, I can't watch, you know, I can't gaze at it. I can't watch it because it is deeply triggering, and it's triggering for all of us in different ways. It's triggering for me primarily because I remember being in Philadelphia when Katrina hit. I remember watching my city underwater. I remember watching bodies float in that water. I remember being upset that you have the capacity to hover over this space and take images, right? And to give us news feed, but you don't have enough helicopters and planes to like get on the ground and get those people out of there. And so I felt a lot of ways around Katrina. So I remember when I first watched the video and I saw Beyonce on top of the car, I said out loud, it's too soon. Hmm. We're not ready to see that. So on the one hand, I get that you're bringing attention to the disparities that happened during Katrina and afterwards. I get that this is a rallying call of sorts as we speak about Black Lives Mattering. But you got to think about those Black lives that you're ultimately impacting as well. And it's a lot of people in New Orleans who are not ready to see those images. It's painful.
My guest today is Yaba Blay. She is Dan Blue Endowed Chair in Political Science at North Carolina Central University and author of the book One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race. Just ahead, we're going to talk with her about the project and about the CNN documentary, all that on The State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio talking to Yaba Blay today, who teaches political science at North Carolina Central and who has written a book, One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race. And I want to talk to you some more about that book. There are profiles of individuals in the book. Talk about the questions you use, the prompt that you use to talk about self-identification.
Well, one of the first questions I ask everyone is, how do you identify racially and culturally? And if you look through the book, you can see which each profile, you see their name and then you see how they specifically identify. So good conversations about the nomenclature that we use, and that there are people who are thinking very critically about what language they use to self-identify. There are people who make a distinction between Black and African-American, Afro-Latino, mix versus biracial. So asking them about how they identify, but then also asking them about their lived experiences.
And this book, I think, makes no effort to sort of sum it up either.
No.
These are individual stories that tell their own story.
Yes.
And then it's up to me to figure out if I want to sum it up. But there is no summary.
No. And what's interesting is the reason why I chose to publish the book independently, because major publishers wanted me to situate myself as an expert on Black identity. They wanted me to define it and say what it is. And I just wasn't trying to do that.
But what are your ideas, particularly after doing this book? And again, I'm not asking you to sum it up, but how have you changed? How have conducting these interviews and editing these responses changed you and your understanding?
You know, it's interesting. When I connect this to my lived experience in New Orleans, growing up adjacent to a Creole community, I think I've always kind of moved through the world with the assumption that if folks could escape Blackness, that they would, that if you could use another term to identify, like Creole, like mixed, like biracial, like Cablin Asian, like Tiger Woods, if you could find another way to identify, that you would. And clearly now I understand that was predicated on some negative reflections on Blackness. Doing this work and talking to people from all over the world who could identify as any myriad of things, who but clearly say, you know, I'm Black, helps me to understand. I think it brought me to a place of just appreciating how beautiful Blackness really is, that there are people who are reaching for it, people who claim it and recognize its beauty and its power. So, I mean, that was powerful for me.
A lot of these folks we would never have heard of. However, Soledad O'Brien does appear. And
yes,
she talks about, just in her entry, a kind of journey that she took in understanding who she was and how to identify.
Yeah, and I think the thing so interesting, interviewing Soledad O'Brien, and I told her this when I first saw her, the very first Black in America, I remember being annoyed, like, who is this woman and why is she anchoring Black in America? Like, is she Black? Right? These questions. And she talks about having that experience walking through airports and people walking up to her and trying to get a closer look to try and find the little specks of Blackness. But for her, I guess I was expecting her to have this long, convoluted explanation of why she's Black. And hers was very simple. My mama said I'm Black. My mama's Black. Therefore, I'm Black. And it was just that simple. Her mother's also Cuban, you know, and so some other kind of cultural nuances. But from very early on, her Blackness wasn't an option for her.
And she also talked about sort of getting past the question, because people are always asking that, what are you? And she came to some kind of understanding about why people might be doing that.
Yeah, just out of, I mean, there's curiosity, right. But then there's also boxes, and we need to put people right. in boxes because we need to know what side you're on or what to do with you. And the thing about Soledad is that she says she doesn't get tired of the questions. There are a lot of people I talk to in the book who are like, stop talking to me, right?
Right.
But she looks at it as an opportunity to engage and to teach.
You talked about that series, Who's Black in America, being angry at first, and then you participated at a certain point.
I did. They asked me to be a producer on the last one that they did, which was based on my work with One Drop. And so we turned it into a visual.
And tell us about that, about just about the experience of doing that with, you know, with a network that may or may not have a deep understanding of what's going on. What was it like for you?
It was interesting. It was great working with Soledad because she gets it. It was great working with the producers because they were interested in seeing how this could translate. But I also recognize that, you know, the media needs an angle. Usually, right? They need a story to kind of run with. They need to make good TV. And I had to early on kind of not detach myself, but just kind of make things clear that this isn't your documentary, Yabba. When you do your documentary, you can do it how you want to do it. But I did push back in a lot of ways, and I was able to make sure that they got some context in, because, again, I'm very much committed to not pathologizing black people any more than we've already been pathologizing. So I didn't want to participate in anything that just made it look like we were crazy black folks out here fighting for no reason.
Let's play a clip from the documentary of Jay Smooth. Jay is the founder of New York's longest-running hip-hop radio program called Underground Railroad, and you also interviewed him for your book, but here he is in the CNN documentary.
I self-identify as black. I grew up as the son of a black father. So although my mother is white, I never saw mixed and black as mutually exclusive. Black culture comes from people being brought to this country systematically cut off from their traditions and culture in Africa and building their own cultural traditions here in America. I feel connected to my Russian heritage and my Jewish ancestry, but a connection to white culture is an alien concept to me.
That's a clip of Jay Smooth from the CNN documentary, Who is Black in America? My guest is North Carolina Central professor Yabba Blay, who is the author of the book One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race. How did you, he's also in the book and in the documentary, how much control over that did you have? Who was going to be on your segment?
We talked about it because, again, they were looking for stories, but I was also looking for folks who were able to articulate in a way that I thought would be eye-opening for some folks. And Jay's great. I mean, he's a media personality, and he's very sharp in certain ways and simple. So I thought his story would be good. But yeah, we definitely talked about it in terms of who would make sense to have on the dot.
You spoke with Danielle Ayers for your book. She's also featured in the documentary. Tell us more about your relationship with her.
So I went to grad school with Danielle at Temple. I remember meeting her and not liking her. I just didn't like her. And it had a lot to do with, again, this kind of performance of black girl code. She would walk in a room and not speak to people. And that's like, you don't do that. You walk in and you say good morning, you say something. And she would just walk in and handle her business and walk out. And I remember none of us were really fooling with her like that. Later on, a mutual professor told me, he's like, you should really get to know Danielle. She wrote this really good paper in my class. And apparently she had written this paper where she was thanking her father for her blackness. So somehow later on we got connected, and she was one of the first interviews I did for this book. And I remember when I interviewed her, she kept looking at me like her eyes are really big. And I'm like, why are you looking at me like that? And she's like, because I can tell, like, you see something different. You know, I was learning in that moment. And so what I learned was that Danielle grew up in the middle of Pennsylvania. You know, once you leave Philadelphia, you're in Kentucky, right? So she grew up in the middle of Pennsylvania in a Mennonite community, daughter of a Mennonite mother and an African-American father. And so to make that picture clearer, when I say a Mennonite community, I mean horse and buggies, mm-hmm. right? And so in that space, she was the blackest thing around. So she remembers going to the market with one of her aunts, her mother's sisters, and having people walk up to her aunt saying, oh, is this your fresh air child for the summer? And so her blackness was screaming in that space. Then she moved to Philadelphia to go to Temple, and folks are like, what are you? Are you Italian? Are you Puerto Rican? And she's like, what are you, crazy? Look, I'm black.
Yeah.
And so she became very quiet in a certain way. So it wasn't that she was walking in the room and being stink. It was just that she didn't know how she was going to be received by people. And so she just kind of retreated into herself.
Here's a bit of your interview with her.
It was this quiet, ignoring that I often felt as though people just didn't really want to mess with me. You know, they really didn't, you know, you're good, stay over there.
How'd you get through?
I left school. I stopped going.
You dropped out.
I didn't officially drop out. They sent a tutor to my house, and that's how I finished my junior year.
She got through that year and the next, graduated and entered Temple University, where she studied for her master's degree in African American studies. She says she had a deep desire to connect with her blackness.
My family is very important to me. My white family is who I grew up around, but even with them, I feel as though I'm black. I'm not the same as them, and I've always felt that way. I know where I feel most comfortable and the way that I want to identify, and the beating that's in me is blackness. It's blackness. There's no question about it.
That's a clip of Danielle Ayers, who's talking with Soledad O'Brien from the CNN documentary Who's Black in America, that particular episode based on a book by my guest, One Drop, Shifting Lens on American Race. It's interesting that you would tell the story that you had a certain prejudice yourself, a certain assumptions, set of assumptions about her behavior, and that only on inquiring did you find out that there's this much deeper story. So this is, again, the power of these stories to actually spend the time to investigate. What did you feel in that moment when you realized you were all wrong about her?
You know, I'm always open to check myself, right? I had a few moments like this in terms of leading to this project. I think the very first moment that led me to this was being on a panel with Rosa Clemente in New York City. And we were talking about colorism in the diaspora, and she kept identifying as a black Puerto Rican woman from the South Bronx. And I remember sitting next to her and being distracted in my head, like, what do you mean you're a black Puerto Rican woman? Like, I know many Puerto Ricans and nobody's saying they're black. And so checking myself, because I'm a professor of African-American studies, I teach my students about the diaspora. I talk about our displacement across the world and how our cultures remain continuous throughout. And that's theoretical. This started getting me into the practical.
What was it like for Danielle to be asked, to be allowed to tell her story?
You know, it made us closer. It made us friends. She definitely thanked me for not even putting her in the project as much as just listening to her. Yeah. Because I think on both sides, you know, not to have anyone be a villain and a victim, but just on both sides, like, you have to be willing to ask somebody a question to get an answer, you know? And so if you're not willing to get to know somebody and know their story, then you walk through life making assumptions about who they are based upon what they look like. I mean, that's fundamentally how race functions in this country.
Well, and that's for Danielle, again, not having been asked, she'll have to make assumptions about who's in the room, having had the lived experience she had both in rural Pennsylvania and then in Philadelphia. What do you tell your students about how to do this? We're all not going to write a book. We're all not going to have the access that you had. And yet you're right. Race operates just under the surface everywhere in America, and it has its effects. What do we do?
I mean, I think my role as an educator in the classroom or anywhere that I speak and engage with people, I'm trying to push critical thinking more than anything. I think that if you learn how to ask the right questions, if you learn how to look at things with a critical lens, you'll come to learn things differently. And so, no, you may not write a book and you may not do a documentary, but you might ask a different question, which will lead you down a different path. So for me, for my students, I want them to check everything. I mean, most times, you know, I teach a lot of classes on media. So I teach a class on hip hop. I teach a class on gender and black popular culture. And I have students tell me all the time, like, I can't watch TV the same. I can't listen to music the same. And I'm like, well, then I've done my job. I'm not telling you not to enjoy it. Because you can enjoy it, but
I think that's critical too. Because we've seen so much criticism of hip hop culture. It's all about the money. It's about misogyny and sort of all the critique that goes around it, which could make a body feel pretty guilty about appreciating a culture that has a great deal of richness as well. And I guess what you're saying is there are ways of sort of critically evaluating all of that.
That's life, though. Everything is nuanced. Everything is complicated. There's no one way to be or experience anything. So I don't feel like I need to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know what I mean? That I can be a black woman, I can be a feminist, and I can very much deeply enjoy hip-hop still.
There are some objective standards, though, ways in which we can measure the impact of race and colorism. And we've got so Sandy Darity, who teaches over at Duke, talked about social privilege that shows that lighter skinned, at least for men and women that this does play a role, and I want to listen to this clip as well.
We found that darker-skinned and medium-skin-toned black men suffered approximately a 10 to 12% penalty in wages relative to white males. But lighter-skinned black males suffered no significant penalty relative to white males.
So there's Duke University's Sandy Darity and the CNN documentary, Who's Black in America? My guest is North Carolina Central professor Yaba Blay, who was a consulting producer for the documentary. I mean, it's important while you're collecting these stories and getting these subjective experiences to realize that there are some objective factors that are really playing.
Oh, absolutely. So that it doesn't just become about these personal stories, right? It's just about what these people are feeling and thinking, but there are no real implications. I mean, colorism is as institutionalized as racism is. But yeah, we've got numbers.
How do you think this message, you know, we talk about this all the time. We've had 8 years of talk about a post-racial America, but a lot of indications that things are not getting too much better on that front. How do you think the communication is going? Are people taking this seriously, or are we all in our silos, choosing to be critical when it's easy for us, and if not, is it having an effect? Are these kinds of messages having any impact, do you think?
I mean, these messages in terms of this work?
This kind of work, getting these stories out here, forcing us for at least an hour to think more critically about how we prejudge and judge and how important these things really are, whether we choose to believe we pay attention to race or not.
I mean, I believe so. I mean, there are people who think the more you talk about race, you know, the worse that it gets. Mm-hmm. But I think you have to talk about it or else we'll be in this space of denial. I mean, the fact that people can even have conversations about a so-called post-racial America, according to who? Who did you talk to? And as evidenced by what? That we have a black man as president? That hasn't changed the terrorism that we're experiencing in this country. If anything, I think it's heightened it. I think the fact that he is in office has actually pushed us to start talking about race differently because we're watching racism play out and we want to be in denial. And so I think the conversations are important and I think they are making an impact where they can.
So that might mean that you're sort of reaching critical mass, that in some ways, because we've delayed this conversation, because we've not had it thoroughly, we've papered over the problem, things are getting worse perhaps because we're talking about it and because this might be leading to actually some improvement.
Yeah,
I'm begging you.
Well, I think that's leading to some improvement. Again, the critical thinking, like I tell my students, you know, to be able to recognize the new racism. So, no, the Klan might not be walking down the street. No, black people might not be getting hosed down. No, we don't have shackles on. But understand that it still exists, and you need to understand what you're seeing when you see it.
Yaba Blay is my guest. She is the Dan Blue Endowed Chair in Political Science at North Carolina Central University, also the author of the book One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race. You can find out more about the book and her other work at our website, stateofthings.org. Yaba Blay, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you for having me.
The program is The State of Things, and we are going to be in Greensboro tomorrow. We're going to be talking about concussions at the collegiate level and what can be done to stop them and to improve the reporting. We'll have live music as well. Join us at the Triad Stage in Greensboro. Just RSVP at our website, stateofthings.org. Produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton Ormond, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.